Throughout our quest to gain an understanding of natura, Latin for nature, we discussed a man by the name of Isaac Newton. He was the physicist, mathematician, the theologian, the astronomer, and the author. As is likely already known, Isaac Newton was perhaps the greatest physicist in human history. In his short, on universal terms, life, he formulated the laws of gravity, the laws of motion, he co-founded calculus, the study of mathematical change, and he authored the scientific revolution. Whilst all of his contributions to physics are taught in every elementary physics class and recognized everywhere, perhaps his most famous contribution to elementary physics was the laws of motion, which help describe the fundamental nature of motion. Furthermore, they initiate thought on the relationship between motion and energy, the notion of vectors in physical science, and the laws of conservation. See chapter 36 for more information. In this chapter, Newton's laws of motion and their mathematical representations will be pertained. All I'll say with this is that it is good to know calculus because it makes everything about physics, elementary physics, so much easier. Knowing the mathematical standpoint, the mathematical basis of a law of physics is exceptionally important, and having a calculus background allows your understanding for physics to be so much greater, so much more profound, so much more in-depth. But yeah, the history of motion as a concept brings us to one of the principal evolutions in human society since the rise of agriculture. That is the evolution from faith-based reasoning to reason-based reasoning. Aristotle once explained the motion and rest of objects in the universe by claiming that each object had a natural position in the universe, quote-unquote. Aristotle claimed that objects such as rocks wanted, quote-unquote again, wanted to stay at rest upon the earth. Objects such as smoke and steam wanted to exist in the sky or within the atmosphere. And objects such as stars and planets, planets were known as wandering stars, which were not known to be planets while Aristotle lived, or laid upon the earth, or lied upon the earth, not laid. But basically, back then, they didn't even know that the planets were planets. They thought they were wandering stars. They thought they were stars in and of themselves. They thought they were the only body on the everywhere, anywhere. But yeah, that's more faith-based reasoning. But like objects such as stars and planets wanted to remain in the sky or in the heavens. This natural state of rest was the ground for Aristotle's belief that every object that maintains its state of motion and its magnitude of motion is influenced by outside forces. This is not technically true in the vacuum at all. Anywhere where there's no force that can act upon an object, this is completely untrue, categorically untrue in a place in which there exists no forces to act upon an object. Aristotle's belief of a force that is needed to maintain motion was eventually realized to be false by Galileo Galilei. Galilei noted that the force was necessary to change the velocity of an object, but no force was required to maintain the velocity of an object. Essentially, Galileo stated that as long as no force acts upon an object maintains its inertia. Very obvious hint, first law of motion, that's exactly what it is. The term inertia itself was first authored by Johannes Kepler, who described the word as an object's resistance to changes in motion. Newton's first law of motion literally restates Galileo's law of inertia. Thus, the credit for the law of motion, first law of motion specifically, was granted to Galileo. The first law of motion had been described, observed, and experimentally validated for over two centuries, and Newton merely described it in terms of his principal book, and that is philosophy. I don't know why I said philosophy, but Philosophy Naturalis Principia Mathematica. That's what it was. And you can see more information on it in chapter 39 or episode 41, but even so, there's more information on a Wikipedia page. But make sure that you don't just search up Principium Mathematica, because it's not the same book. Make sure you search up the entire Philosophy Naturalis, Principia Mathematica. And then, well, there you go. You'll get information on it from there. Newton's first law of motion in Principia Mathematica, which is not technically Newton's book, but it's the one by Newton. That, let's say it's a Principia Mathematica that's by Newton. Describes inertia. In Principia Mathematica, Newton describes inertia in the realms of the first law of motion. He says this, quote-unquote, the vis incita, or innate force of matter, I think that's what the Wikipedia page was saying outside of it, is a power of resisting by which every body, as much as in it lies, endeavors to preserve its present state, whether it be of rest or of moving uniformly forward in a straight line. So that was easy to understand. Now we're going to put it into New English, because remember that this is the late 17th century, so Old English is different than New English, and most people in our present society do not have vocabularies anywhere near as wide as this. Thus, we are forced to dumb it down. Good job, progressing forward, society. But anyway, basically, this describes inertia. Inertia as the property of an object's resistance to a change in motion when unaffected by any external force is the principal notion of Newton's first law, which states that an object at rest will stay at rest, and an object in motion will remain in motion unless acted upon by a net external force. So an external force that is not just two even forces acting opposite of one another, because if that's the case, then nothing's going to happen. It's just going to continue to move. But if they're unequal forces that are unequally acting upon that object, then of course, undoubtedly, there will be a net change and inertia will not be maintained. Mathematically, if the sum of the forces acting upon an object equals zero, then there will be no change in velocity of an object, or the net external forces equals zero. For example, if an in-motion object has an equal amount of forces propelling it forward as it has forces holding it back, then the sum of the net external forces acting upon that object equals zero. Thus, the derivative velocity with respect to time, so acceleration, is zero. It's just continuing to move and it's not slowing down. In other words, if no net external force is acting upon the object, it will remain at motion or at rest. We can represent this with the relationship, the summation of F. There's no bound, there are no bounds, but the summation of F, the sum of F equals zero. When the sum of F equals zero, that means that the derivative of velocity with respect to time is zero, or acceleration is zero, if you want to make it not derivatives. But that's basically what it is. The second derivative of displacement is acceleration. The first derivative of velocity is acceleration. That's where we get it from. And of course, the summation, sigma, summation, same thing, sum, is the sum of the external forces. So imagine forces as being positive and negative net forces on the motion of an object, and you'll see that the summation, the sum of 1 and negative 3 is negative 2, like something like that, similar to that. I mean, that's wildly more simplistic than summation, but either way, similar. Of course, F is force, V is velocity, and T is time. D over D is derivative with respect to something. This relationship states that if the summation of the external forces on an object equals zero, then the derivative of velocity with respect to time is zero, meaning that the velocity is unchanged over a unit of time and the object is not accelerating or decelerating. So, yeah. The first law of motion is applicable in only an inertial frame of reference. Also, the second law is. Both the first and the second laws are only applicable in an inertial frame of reference. So all I can say is imagine yourself. So let's say that there is a bus driving past you at 17 meters per second. So you're going at 17, there's a bus driving past you at 17 meters per second. Now, if you are on a park bench going 0 meters per second, you will observe that if that object is remaining in motion, like you're in a vacuum, there's no friction or anything, and that object is remaining in motion, it maintains its inertia, then you wouldn't see it either accelerating or decelerating. It would just be moving at a constant velocity. But if you were to be going, let's say you were going 19 meters per second, it's going 17, it is going to seem as if it is going behind you. It is not going to be, you can't really measure it. It's going to appear as if it's going -2 meters per second. So it has to be an inertial frame of reference. I mean, technically, well, actually, inertial frame of reference, a little more specifically, inertial frame of reference, specifically, if you are accelerating. So if you're the frame of reference and you are accelerating or decelerating, then the first law of motion does not apply as you observe another object. So not you going at 19 meters per second, but how about you accelerating at 19 meters per second, which is ridiculously fast. But imagine you accelerating at 19 meters per second. You would not be able to observe the bus, which is accelerating at 0 kilometers or meters per second, or really kilometers per second, because you are not in an inertial frame of reference. An inertial frame of reference is basically meaning that acceleration, or the derivative of velocity with respect to time of that reference frame, is zero, just straight zero. It cannot be -1, it cannot be 1. It has to be 0. That's more specifically what an inertial reference frame is. It's not, you can be traveling at 19 kilometers per second because you would technically be going 2 kilometers or 19 meters per second, because you're technically going 2 meters per second faster than the bus, and it wouldn't appear that it's decelerating. But if you were not aware of it and you were accelerating at 19 meters per second, it would appear that the bus is decelerating in a way at 19 meters per second. That's essentially what is happening. The first law of motion has been verified by observation for hundreds of years, as we know, prior to Newton's mathematical statements of the laws, but one could assume that the major problem was the fact that the laws of motion, particularly the first law of motion and the second, were not described through mathematics because it required calculus. With the introduction of calculus, specifically differential calculus, Isaac Newton was able to explain the laws of motion through derivatives, as is known with the first law of motion. When the derivative of velocity with respect to time of an object is zero, or the acceleration is zero, the sum of the net external forces acting upon that object is zero. So with calculus, we were able to explain physics in a better than we had before. Now the second law is similar, but different. Of course, it deals with motion, but it's not the same law, because it's its own unique law. Momentum, or P, momentum is represented by P. If you think of the mass energy, or the mass momentum energy equivalence, if you think about light, in the original equation, E squared equals M squared C fourth, C to the fourth power, plus P squared C squared. With a massless object, mass equals zero, so thus you only have E squared equals P squared C squared, and P obviously is momentum in this situation. So a light, for example, has momentum, and that's how its energy equivalence is stated. So E equals PC, because of course you take the square root of both sides, E squared equals P squared C squared, E equals PC. But we get momentum everywhere. Momentum does not only occur in just classical mechanics. We see it in relativity, because the mass energy equivalence and the momentum energy equivalence exists in relativity as well. So it's of course important. And momentum itself is a vector quantity that describes the quantity of motion of a moving body. Momentum is not the same as velocity, for it also describes motion through the mass of an object. So an object's momentum is the product of its velocity and its mass. So rather than being merely its velocity, it is, in a way, both. Both velocity and mass. This can be seen through the standard unit of momentum, of course, which is kilogram meters per second. That's momentum. So obviously you can see it explains it through mass. The second law of motion describes momentum in terms of its interactions with force. The second law of motion states that the rate of change, or derivative, of momentum of an object over time is directly proportional to the amount of force applied upon it. The change in momentum in an object as a result of forces acting upon it occurs in the same direction in which the force was applied. This is pretty common. Imagine you pushing someone, you're pushing them with force, and they go forward. They're not going to go into you unless you're pulling them toward you. That's basically, it travels parallel to the direction at which the forces were applied, what the acted upon object. Mathematically, the second law of motion states that the derivative of momentum P with respect to time T is proportional to the quantity of force F. So the relationship is F equals dp over dt, or the derivative of momentum with respect to time. The derivative quantity relationship is only a general mathematical relationship that still applies to constant mass systems, for the second law can be restated depending on whether the object is of constant or of variable mass. And also you're going to see that we can get the very, very well-known equation F, or really relationship F equals ma, because remember that the derivative of momentum with respect to time is basically mass is constant in this situation. We're not talking about relativity. This is classical mechanics. So mass is constant. Mass is a constant that you can take out of this derivative. And unless in a constant mass system, you can take out mass as a constant. And you'll see that you'll only have the derivative of velocity with respect to time. And what is the derivative of velocity with respect to time? Acceleration. F equals ma, and we'll see this here. So for an object with constant mass, Newton's second law of motion can be restated in terms of the object's acceleration. And this is, of course, the second derivative of its displacement. Instead of the relationship between force and the derivative of the object's momentum with respect to time, F equals the derivative of momentum with respect to time, the mass of the object is a coefficient to its potentially variable velocity. Thus, if we were to have the initial relationship F equals the derivative of momentum with respect to time, we could split up momentum P into mass and velocity, for momentum is the product of mass and velocity. As a result, the new relationship is F equals the derivative of mass time, the derivative of mass and velocity with respect to time. As this object has a constant mass, M is a constant. It is really a coefficient when multiplied into a variable, of course. Meaning that as a result of derivative properties, simple ones, it can be multiplied into the entire derivative. This can be expressed as F equals M times the derivative of velocity with respect to T. As the derivative of an object's velocity with respect to time is the second derivative of displacement or acceleration, we can now obtain the universally recognizable equation F equals ma, which I'm sure is not unrecognizable, and I'm sure some of you that are listening to me know exactly what I am talking about. On the other hand, a variable mass object is an object whose mass varies with time. This was certainly not self-explanatory sarcasm. While the second law is not difficult to comprehend, its mathematical representation in terms of a variable mass system is not as straightforward, to the point at which Wikipedia even itself says that the second law's application to variable mass objects can be confusing. As a result, another derivative must be added to the equation. The new relationship is F plus velocity times the derivative of mass with respect to time equals mass times the derivative of velocity with respect to time, or ma, where v is the relative velocity of the escaping or incoming mass, so the v multiplied into the derivative of mass with respect to time, and the derivative of m with respect to t is the derivative of mass with respect to time, of course. Essentially, the sum of the external force and the product of the relative velocity of the escaping or incoming mass on or from the object and the mass flow rate, derivative of mass with respect to time, is equivalent to the object's initial mass, this is what I assume, but I cannot be certain of this, of course, multiplied by its acceleration, or the derivative of velocity with respect to time. As a result, a similar but different relationship exists between force, mass, and acceleration, where merely the transfer of mass is indicated in the relationship. This is now F plus V times the derivative of mass with respect to time, so relative velocity of the incoming material, equals mass times acceleration. So we had force equals mass times acceleration. back there. Now it's a little bit more complicated just to kind of make it less difficult or more difficult. But however, in some situations, the relative velocity of the incoming mass with times the derivative of mass with respect to time can technically be eliminated from the equation because it's actually considered a force. Like this happens with rocket fuel, for example. Obviously, that's a variable mass object, but the release of it is a force that basically propels the rocket upward or whatever direction they wish. And of course, as a result, these can be eliminated from the equation and it can just represent F equals ma, and it would just be F equals ma again. Newton's second law of motion is just like the first law of motion, applicable only in an inertial reference frame. That is, again, a reference frame that is neither accelerating nor decelerating. The third law of motion isn't as mathematically explicable as were the first and second laws of motion, but it remains relatively straightforward. The third law of motion states that, this will be very recognizable, for every action or force in nature, there is an equal and opposite reaction or change in the position of the object acted upon. To illustrate this, we're going to use a really relatively not straightforward example. Let's picture a standard car, Tesla Model S plaid. In this car, an engine, or in the case of our new 2021 Tesla Model S plaid, not sponsored, a motor, converts either potential, chemical, or potential electrical energy into kinetic mechanical energy, pushing the wheels and causing them to move backward. Think about clockwise motion against the road. Consequently, the road is pushed backwards, and as every action has an equal and opposite reaction, the force applied on the road causing it to move backward causes the car to move forward. If you are confused, pause your reading or listening and think about it for a moment. Yes, examples like this are abstract. Another easier to understand example is the relationship between two perfectly balanced skateboarders as they push the other with equal and opposite force, opposite direction. Then they both would theoretically move the exact same distance backward. As a result, the force of their pushing one another grants an equal and opposite reaction, this being their backward movement. This situation where the two skateboarders represent the third law of motion gives us the opportunity to think unnecessarily critically. While this particular outcome, where the two skateboarders travel equal and opposite distances after pushing one another with equal force, there inevitably exists reason for criticism. First off, if the two travel the same distance back, we must ask, what if there exists more friction between skater 1's wheels and the ground than skater 2's wheels and the ground? What if the second skater's skateboard is pushed into the grass rather than the cement? What if the first skater's wheels are more used than the second skater's, thus they're less smooth? What if the second skater's skateboard has a different center of gravity as a result of the skater's position upon the board? All of these questions cause us to set parameters, and this is a very fundamental thing in physics, especially in mechanical physics that exist on Earth. These cause us to set parameters. For the third law of motion to apply perfectly to our example, and basically any law of motion, we must say that the wheels of each skateboard and the ground have the same level of friction, the center of gravity on both skateboarders' skateboards are the same, the two skaters are the exact same people, same body build, same weight, same height, and do their experiments at the exact same time. More air pressure increases air resistance, thus they must do it under the same atmospheric conditions. The two skaters must have the same skateboard and the same clothes, and the two skaters must push one another on the exact same surface. There, of course, are far more parameters than merely the ones set in our thought experiment, but the complications of this simple experiment represent the multitude of outside factors and fundamental laws, such as the third law of motion. Even with the simple example of two skaters pushing against one another, we forget other forces that act upon the skaters. For some examples, air resistance is drag force that acts upon the two skaters, thus their movement will be affected by air resistance. The wind acting upon the skaters, even if pointing in the same direction and traveling at uniform speed, will act on one of the skaters by pushing him or her further backward, while it will act on the other skater by pushing him or her less backward, or even forward. and an uneven frictional force between the ground and the wheels will slow the two skaters down unevenly. Even so, the third law of motion is unequivocal fact. Thus, it needs no perfect explanation or experiment to prove its truth. Again, well, this is different. It's not as much a... It doesn't branch into relativity like the first two do. But the first law of motion definitely branches into relativity. Not the greatest. A formal mathematical representation of the third law of motion is best represented through both vectors. The mathematical quantities have both magnitude and directions. Forces are vectors. And the simple relationship F1 equals negative F2. So F1 is equal in magnitude and opposite in direction to F2. In terms of the forces as vector quantities, if the force applied in our two skaters on a skateboard example, then the forces of the two pushing one another, if equal, will be vectors of the same magnitude, but opposite direction. Formally, we could represent this relationship as the vector F1 equals the negative vector F2. Newton's laws of motion apply specifically to what are used as single point masses, where the size and the shape of the object are abandoned to focus on the laws of motion, or to focus on the object's motion with less difficulty. Consequently, it is found that Newton's laws of motion cannot be applied to objects that are rigid. Rigid bodies are unaffected by force, where the distance between two points on the rigid body is unchanged by force acting upon it. And those laws cannot be applied to objects that are deformable. Deformation results from applied forces, which very obviously means that a force acting upon a deformable object will deform the object, therefore not causing as much displacement as there would be, because this is a law of motion, not a law of deformity. Nevertheless, Newton's laws of motion are applicable to a wide variety of what my physics teacher describes as medium-sized objects, rightfully so. Newtonian motion applies to macroscopic objects in everyday life, but they do not and cannot describe the exceptionally small or the exceptionally large. They can't even describe the exceptionally fast or the exceptionally gravitationally bound, as in objects traveling at relativistic speeds and objects within significant gravitational fields. As will undoubtedly be discussed in future chapters, Newtonian mechanics, including the laws of motion, do not apply to phenomena such as superconductivity, optical properties of substances, errors in uncorrected GPS systems, they must be corrected to respond to time dilation, among others, many others. Some consider the existence of a fourth law of motion as assumed, but not stated by Isaac Newton. The postulated fourth law states that forces add together like vectors add together, meaning that they obey the principle of superposition, which is not synonymous with quantum superposition. This principle of superposition states that the net response of a system caused by multiple stimuli is the same thing as the sum of the responses that each individual stimulus would have caused. If 45 newtons are applied through three separate stimuli in the exact same direction, and if each 15 newton increment caused an object to displace 4 meters, then the sum of the displacement, of course, is 12 meters. This distance can be represented by the three separate increments of 15 newtons, so 45 divided by 15 times 4, which is 12, or the total net response of the object, and that is 12 meters. This law of motion was never directly stated by Newton, and it is currently not accepted as a fourth law of motion, but it is assumed by some scientists. Unlike the last six episodes, this episode stands on its own. Unlike the last six episodes, this is not a two-part semi-series. In this chapter, we covered a basic topic that virtually anyone with a middle school education has heard of, but few have learned in depth. In this chapter, we covered Isaac Newton's three laws of motion and analyzed their mathematical relationships, which are also very well known for most with a middle school education. An almost universally known relationship is F equals MA, or F equals force equals mass times acceleration, which describes the second law of motion as a relationship between force and mass and acceleration. Additionally, we covered two of the most well-known phrases in all of science. If a body is at rest, it will stay at rest, and if a body is in motion, it will stay in motion, unless acted upon by an external force or an outside force. And every action has an equal and opposite reaction. So that was the first law and the third law, respectively. Anyway, thank you all for listening, and as always, have a good morning, afternoon, evening, and night. If you'd like to support the podcast, please click the link in the episode or any episode's description. And subscribe, as one would do on Patreon, but without the extra perks. Anyway, take care and stay curious.